loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two stories. First, in a major shift, U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have issued a call for a ceasefire in Yemen within the next 30 days. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump and his advisors are pushing ahead with his theory that he can revoke birthright citizenship by signing an executive order. Most Republican leaders and constitutional scholars have condemned the president's position on the basis that it violates the 14th Amendment, but the issue will likely have to be settled in the courts. Next, an Israeli airstrike killed three young Palestinian boys on Sunday evening near the fence that separates Israel from Gaza. Israeli authorities said that one of the aircraft rocketed the boys, two aged 13 and one 14, while they were planting explosives. Palestinian authorities, however, said that was nonsense. Then, New Zealand's government said today that a landmark 11-country trade deal that would slash tariffs and increase trade will come into effect at the end of December after being ratified by New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and Singapore. The Trump administration withdrew from the Pacific Rim Trade Pact early last year to, in President Trump's words, prioritize protecting American jobs. And then Chabahar is an Iranian port on the Indian Ocean, Iran's only direct access to open ocean. The port was built and developed by Indian companies working with the government of India to expand that country's ability to trade with the rest of the world, but especially with Afghanistan. The idea was a good one for virtually all of the economies in the area, but now U.S. sanctions on Iran threaten the port's viability. And finally, the Cook Political Report, arguably the most highly respected political analysis outlet in the country, reported today that Democrats may be on the brink of a major sweep of governor's mansions in every Great Lakes state with an election this year. Democratic gains would have lasting importance because of the upcoming 2020 census and the resultant mandate to draw new congressional district borders. And in other headlines, Donald Trump defended his trip to Pittsburgh yesterday, tweeting, quote, "We were treated so warmly. Small protest was not seen by us, staged far away," unquote. This appeared to be in response to reports that his motorcade had to be rerouted as a result of a demonstration of hundreds of people that took place denouncing what they identified as his bigoted right-wing rhetoric. While in Pittsburgh, Trump met with the rabbi of the synagogue that was targeted in the anti-Semitic terrorist attack that took place over the weekend and that resulted in the loss of 11 lives. South Sudan took a major step toward peace today as rebel leader Riek Machar returned to the country for the first time in 2 years. Machar has returned to take part in a ceremony celebrating the newly signed peace deal. There have been several similar peace agreements since the civil war broke out in 2013 as a result of a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Machar, who was then the country's vice president. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee said that it has reached the $100 million mark for online fundraising. This far surpasses what the committee had raised online at this point in the 2016 election, $67 million. The DCCC is the main fundraising vehicle for Democrats in the House of Representatives. The United Nations has appointed a new envoy to Syria. That's Norwegian diplomat Geir Pedersen. He's tasked with facilitating an agreement to end the war in the country that has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. Pedersen was part of a team involved in the negotiation of the historic Oslo Accords in 1993. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Yemen. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called today for all participants in the Yemen war to begin a ceasefire within 30 days. The two said that within 30 days they wanted all parties to engage in peace talks that would be led by UN Special Envoy Martin Griffiths. No venue for talks has yet been announced. We are joined from Virginia by Gareth Porter. Gareth is a historian. He's an investigative journalist. He's an analyst specializing in U.S. National Security Policy and the author of the book Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Gareth Porter, welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot. Glad to be back on your show.
Thank you so much. I mean, I have to say, this was a little bit of a startling announcement in one way. I mean, we wouldn't have anticipated it, say, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, but a lot's happened in the last couple of weeks, especially with the fortunes of Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, following the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Anyway, Gareth, let's try to put this all, you know, let's put this in a big picture way, but also to sort of help the audience understand what's changed, what's new, why is this happening?
Well, that's not very difficult from my point of view to figure out. And the answer is quite simply that the political support in the U.S. Political elite has pretty much collapsed for the bin Salman regime, for Mohammed bin Salman, and the hardline U.S. support for the Saudi position in Yemen specifically. And that has taken various forms, but I think the key thing is that within Congress, there is far more readiness now to basically call a halt to U.S. support for the Saudis in Yemen and to insist that the U.S. End its active involvement, specifically in the Saudi coalition war in Yemen, the bombing of the population, and, of course, the continued, basically, the effort and the successful effort to prevent humanitarian goods from flowing into Yemen, which is even more devastating, really, than the population bombing by the Saudi coalition.
Gareth Porter, you recently posted, I think in the last day or so, an article that you wrote back in April 2017. I think the title, in a way, says it all. The U.S. provided cover for the Saudi starvation strategy in Yemen. Talk about that.
Well, this is really crucial to understand because I think it's generally not understood just how strongly the Obama administration supported the Saudi military effort in Yemen. And in doing so, they were really enabling the Saudis to do something that they should not have been able to get away with, because the Saudis were, from very early on in 2015, carrying out a strategy that was not simply carrying out bombing of populated areas. That's well known. But what was less understood, definitely, was that they were isolating the population of Yemen from international shipments of goods that were vital, not just to dealing with humanitarian problems because of the war, but basically to keep that economy running. So Yemen depends on the international trade in food for 90% of its economy. And what the Saudis were doing quite consciously was preventing Yemen from getting the food necessary to support its population. And the United States knew that perfectly well, but they provided the kind of diplomatic cover, particularly in the United Nations, that was really necessary for the Saudis to get away with this. And they did so over and over again, as I document in my article. It was really a major scandal that was not well covered, really not covered at all in the U.S. news media, except for a journalist named Samuel Oakford, who did a wonderful job of revealing what had gone on at the United Nations.
Gareth Porter is our guest. I'm looking at a headline from the Wall Street Journal. It's today. The headline is Saudi Royals Rally to Protect the Family. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's position as heir to the Saudi throne appears secure despite international criticism of a murder, that being the murder of Khashoggi. Now, but as you get into the article, in the meat of the article, I want to read a couple sentences and then get both of you to respond. Saudi Arabia's royal family is closing ranks to protect the monarchy from a storm of criticism after the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate. For now, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's position as heir to the throne appears secure. Royals and people close to the ruling family say, but as international pressure has mounted, octogenarian King Salman has resumed a more active role in the government, and his 33-year-old son's power could be diluted, those people said. Early Tuesday, one of the king's younger brothers, who opposed Prince Mohammed bin Salman's promotion to crown prince, that would be Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, returned to Saudi Arabia in a move seen by people close to the royal family and foreign officials as an effort to share up support for the monarchy. So closing ranks around Mohammed bin Salman for the moment, getting rid of all of his aides and advisors, and bringing back the old guard.
This is going to be done, I think, in two parts. We're seeing the first part here. The first part is to ensure the continued rule, the continued viability of the royal family. This is normally done in the what's called the family council. It's chaired by the king, of course. All the senior princes are members, and then at a lower level, every male royal family member has a collaborative vote, so to speak. So what they want to do is ensure their continued rule. Once that is assured, and I think it's assured now, then they can turn their attention to Mohammed bin Salman. I think it's true, and I think Gareth would agree with me, that Mohammed bin Salman is probably in no danger right now of being deposed, only because he's either exiled or arrested any family member that could likely be a threat to him.
But now they're coming back.
And you have Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, the king's younger brother, and there are only something like four brothers, four sons of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz bin Saud, who are still alive and who don't want to be king themselves. They were happy to, in the family council, they were happy to allow that transition to the younger generation. But they're not going to take this kind of treatment lying down. And so Ahmed bin Abdulaziz has returned from London and finds himself all of a sudden again in a position of influence where he can put some pressure on his brother to rein in Mohammed bin Salman.
And coming back from London, he went to London after having been detained by Mohammed bin Salman.
That's right.
So now he's back as his advisor from the jail, the hotel jail, to exile and then back to be the advisor to your jailer. Amazing. Gareth, go ahead.
No, I'm no Saudi expert by any means, and I'm not going to pose as one at all. But, you know, it seems very clear that the kind of politics that are unfolding in Saudi Arabia is a reflection of the narrowness of the discussion, the narrowness of the politics. It's family politics, and it can get very, very nasty very quick. And I think it's pretty well known that there's always the possibility that something physically can happen to bin Salman. And I think he's very, very conscious of that at all times. That's one of the ways that is easiest for political change to take place in Saudi Arabia.
Who's winning the war right now? If there's a ceasefire now, let's say it's just, you know, all forces stay in place. Is there a winner here?
Well, look, I mean, this is a key point, because when the Trump administration finally agreed to put some pressure on the Saudis on the question of the war in Yemen, it was not just calling for a ceasefire, it was to negotiate with the Houthis. And the Saudis don't really want to do that. And what is not well understood is that when they last called for, when the UN called for negotiations in Geneva, the Saudis would not allow the Houthi delegation to get to the negotiations. And they have detained the plane that the Houthis had used in the past to reach Europe in Djibouti for months. And the UN knows that. And so the UN has been remiss in not doing more to force the hand of the Saudis. And this goes back to the fact that the Saudis with the U.S. have had a kind of veto power over the politics surrounding the Yemen war ever since it began. So I think that's now going to change, and the Saudis are going to be aware of that, and that is going to force their hand. And I think what the Saudis don't want to have happen is that the Houthis will remain in place in the places where they have been successful militarily. And so a ceasefire in place will mean that there is this political compromise that the Saudis have sought to avoid.
Gareth, one of the things that is a mystery to me, and I think it's probably a mystery to most Saudi watchers here in the country, is clearly the Iranians are major players in this conflict. Even if they're not providing weapons to the Houthis, and they may be, they may not be, we really don't know because we only really hear propaganda from the Saudi side. But first of all, would the Iranians be at the table with the UN Special Envoy? And should the Iranians be at the table with the UN Special Envoy?
I would say the answer to both those questions is no. I don't think the Iranians have any desire to be at the table on behalf of the Houthis. They do not view themselves, as I understand it, in any way as the sponsors of the Houthis, as the ones who guarantee their existence or their power. And in fact, what is not very well known, but is extremely important to understand, is that when the Houthis did in fact seize power in 2014 in Sana'a, the Iranians warned them against doing so. They warned them against any effort to try to use military force to conquer larger territory. And the Houthis paid no attention to them. They were then in an alliance with former president of Yemen, Mohammed Saleh. And so they were getting their arms from Saleh at the time that they were increasing their power dramatically and gaining ground militarily very rapidly. So I think the Iranians have helped them. They have, no question, they've provided them with lots of money and probably with some arms as well. But they began this war very clearly with the support of Saleh and with a huge investment, a huge supply of arms that were provided by the Yemeni army, which were provided by the United States originally to the Yemeni army.
The U.S. government, Gareth Porter, the Pentagon in particular, they not only provide the money and the weapons to Saudi Arabia for the war, they also coordinate bombing targets. They assist in the refueling of Saudi bombers. It really can't be viewed as a Saudi war. I mean, it's a Saudi-U.S. war. In terms of the American government's apparent shift now with James Mattis's declaration and Mike Pompeo and the growing chorus of opposition against U.S. support for Saudi Arabia following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, where do you think the United States wants to end this? I mean, if the Houthis control most of the country, which it appears right now they do, if they retain their authority, their control over this territory, does the United States government, will the Trump administration, will the Pentagon view that as an irreplaceable loss, or will the U.S. find a way, in fact, to extend some sort of relationship with the Houthis, especially if they have some distance from Iran and if they have their own more narrow agenda for their own country?
Well, that's a question that is a little bit difficult to answer, because the United States, of course, has had contacts with the Houthis in the past, but have never certainly had any kind of a political relationship with them. And it seems like a bit of a stretch to think that the United States would at this point really attempt to establish a political relationship with the Houthis, but nothing's totally impossible. I think that if you try to analyze what the interests of the executive branch of the United States, of the national security state, if you will, of the United States, both under the Obama administration and the Trump administration really are, they really don't care very much about Yemen per se. What they care about is this relationship with the Saudis. And I constantly stress this point, but I think it's not sufficiently understood that U.S. policy in the Middle East has revolved around these two relationships with its key allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia. And of course, each of those two has very different contours and different different benefits to the national security state or to the White House, as the case may be. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, those benefits have to do with the enormous amount of money that flows into the Pentagon from arms sales to the Saudis, the UAE, but particularly the Saudis, and the access to that key naval base in Bahrain, which the Saudis actually control, because Bahrain is a dependency of Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis have made it very clear, beginning with the Obama administration, that if the Obama administration were to push it too strongly in regard to human rights in Bahrain, the Saudis would start moving elsewhere to the Russians and the Chinese, and the U.S. access would be in danger. So that has been central to the politics of U.S. policy in the Middle East ever since the U.S. and the Saudis began to have this very, very, very close relationship, both militarily and also, I should add, in terms of covert operations by the CIA, which the Saudis have been providing a very large-scale economic or financial support for ever since the jihadi war that the U.S. and the Saudis ginned up in Afghanistan against the Soviets.
Gareth Porter is our guest. Gareth is an investigative journalist. He's a historian. We're talking about the startling new news that the U.S. government announced through James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, has called for a ceasefire in the war in Yemen. You know, John, this is Gareth's point is the most important point in some ways for our audience to understand, which is the linchpin of U.S. Middle East strategy in this resource-rich and geostrategically important part of the world is based on Israel and based on Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
Now, you and I, John, when we were interviewing Saudi opposition forces, dissidents, about Jamal Khashoggi, they said that they had detected before the killing of Khashoggi some sort of discontent going on in Washington with the current constellation in the Saudi royal family.
That's right.
That people were starting to speculate what's going to happen, because it appeared that Saudi Arabia, under the leadership of Mohammed bin Salman, had thought that it could grow wings and start to fly on its own.
You know, and the thing is, too, if I could interrupt you for one second.
Sure.
The Saudi royal family is very, very collaborative. These kinds of internal coups, which is really how Mohammed bin Salman came to power, normally don't happen. I mean, there's a precedent for it. King Saud was overthrown in the mid-1960s. And then most recently, Mohammed bin Nayef was overthrown or deinstalled, I guess we could say, by Mohammed bin Salman. But the royal family is very uncomfortable with these sudden shifts in power. It bothers them. They don't like it. They're not comfortable with it. And they don't think it's good for their long-term survival.
Yeah. So Mohammed bin Salman, 32 years old, perceived as reckless, as carrying out a power play, the opposite of a consensus politician within the Saudi royal family. Now weakened as a consequence of the international uproar over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist, in a Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Gareth, I'm reading again from the Wall Street Journal. This is from a Saudi royal family sort of spokesperson off the record. There is an appreciation that together we stand and divided we fall. There is a degree of fear and panic here. Again, this is an article that came today, fear and panic. And as a consequence, pulling together, limiting, it seems, the power of Mohammed bin Salman, and then also being prepared, I guess, to take the direction now again of Washington, its traditional patron, regarding the Yemen war. Again, going back to your point, though, and I want you to go back to it. During the Nixon era, the so-called Nixon doctrine, we had the United States really focused on the power of the Shah of Iran and Israel as the necessary axis to maintain U.S. interests in this area. Of course, Iran had a revolution. The Shah was no more. That's when the Saudis became sort of maybe indispensable in a way for the Washington establishment. And now, do you think that there's fear and panic, Gareth, not just in Riyadh, but possibly in Washington, that this whole thing, if left unattended, could unravel with the Saudi royal family?
You know, you probably have seen the same sorts of speculative analyses over the last several years that I have from people who know something about Saudi Arabia and who are familiar with the thinking within the U.S. administrations. There has been a lot of talk over the past several years about the real possibility of an unraveling of this whole Saudi regime, because it's regarded as really a weak kind of regime with not the usual attributes of power that one finds in the world, and one that is particularly vulnerable to losing its legitimacy and thus fading away, because there is a lot of internal opposition within Saudi Arabia. Even though the royal family is very big, there is a lot of discontent in Saudi Arabia. There are Shia within Saudi Arabia who inhabit the part of the country that is oil rich, particularly oil rich. And there are other problems that really make a lot of people within the national security elite of the United States nervous about the future of Saudi Arabia. So it would not be surprising if there was a lot of discussion very quietly in Washington right now about that possibility.
Gareth Porter is our guest. Gareth, in our last 90 seconds, the Yemen war has been an unspeakable horror. I mean, the catastrophe, the level of famine, the level of disease. In our last 90 seconds or so, could it be actually coming to an end?
It's very possible now that it could come to an end, yes. I think that this is kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. It was, as you've just said, an unspeakable horror. It should have ended, should have never started in terms of U.S. support for it. But you know, the way it's unfolded, it should have been ended long, long ago when it became obvious that the consequences were so horrible. This has revealed, I think, the degree to which the U.S. political elite is without any moral compass whatsoever in regard to this kind of moral issue. And I think that's really the bottom line for me about this entire episode.
Yes, and I think it's important, Gareth, and I'm glad that you mentioned the absence of a moral compass. It's not simply Donald Trump or the current crew in Washington. This was going on under President Obama. It was going on with the Pentagon under President Obama. It's been going on administration after administration after administration. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Virginia by Gareth Porter. Gareth is a historian. He's an investigative journalist, and he's an analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He is the author of the book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We are joined from Monroe, Michigan, by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer and Sputnik News analyst Nicole Roussel. Kevin, Nicole, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Kevin, you sound better than you did last week. You're obviously recovering from your illness. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
We have a number of big stories, really, really important stories on this front. Let's get started. South Carolina?
Well, my colleagues at groups like Friends of the Earth and Sierra Club chapter of South Carolina are doing great work down there trying to get back the many billions of dollars stolen from ratepayers and wasted on a canceled proposed new nuclear power plant project. Two reactors canceled last year at a cost of $9 billion. And so the proceedings before the South Carolina Public Service Commission begin tomorrow on who's going to pay and how much money will the ratepayers get back.
And what's likely to happen?
Well, there is some hope that money will be returned. I don't know if the full amount will be returned, but they're doing the good work, and there's a lot of blame to go around from the state of South Carolina, the governor, the legislature, certainly the Public Service Commission itself, certainly the companies themselves, which hid the bad news for as long as they could, not only from the public, not only from elected officials, but from their own shareholders. So there still are investigations underway of criminal wrongdoing, fraud, and that kind of thing. So we'll see what happens.
What's the worst case scenario versus the best case scenario here? I mean, didn't this whole project waste $9 billion of ratepayer money? So it could be up to $9 billion that ratepayers end up paying for?
Yeah. So best case scenario, the entire amount is returned to ratepayers. And then worst case scenario, nothing is returned. And so it'll probably be somewhere in between. And it's small nonprofit environmental groups like Friends of the Earth and Savannah Riverside Watch and Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, Sierra Club. That is who is advocating on the public interest.
And there's a similar fight going on in Canada, right, where there's major pushback that's happening against a new generation of atomic reactors. It's, again, more potential waste going on.
Yeah, the nuclear power industry really has its claws into the Canadian federal government, the provincial government of Ontario. It's been that way for decades, and they just throw their political power around, and they've decided they want a whole new chapter of the Canadian nuclear industry in the form of small modular reactors. And they will be looking to the Canadian public to pay for it. Chances are they would be located on the Great Lakes shorelines in many cases, as are the old, dangerously degraded reactors up in Canada right now. And folks are pushing back. Greenpeace Canada, the Canadian Environmental Law Association, Northwatch. There was a letter sent to the Canadian government by dozens of Canadian environmental groups pointing out that, you know, there hasn't even been an environmental assessment. It's looking like the nuclear power industry is going to try to get away with not doing one. And so they're watchdogging that situation.
Yeah, in that press release, Northwatch, who you mentioned, made a comment, so-called small modular reactors are just the nuclear industry's old promise of producing cheap, safe, and clean power recycled into a new request for taxpayer dollars. The federal government shouldn't support these unproven, risky reactor designs. What are small modular reactors?
Well, it's very true what Northwatch has said. Some of these designs go back, including to the 1950s. So these are not new designs. They're just smaller in size. But 300 megawatts is not so small. That's approaching and surpassing the size of reactors that have been built in the past in North America. The modular part is supposed to be a cost-saving measure where they cookie-cutter produce them in factories, the large nuclear components, or the not-so-large in this case. But all that means is you could have a generic defect. We've seen that before in the nuclear power industry. So it's just another pie-in-the-sky promise that this is going to be clean, safe, and very cost-effective. And we've been hearing that from the nuclear power industry since the 1950s. So it's a case of, you know, burn me once, burn me twice. And folks are seeing past the lies at this point.
That feels like a trend, something that, you know, we've heard a number of stories from you over the year of doing this segment, and all of them have one thing in common. They have a lot of things in common, but one thing in common is that they're all extremely expensive, and it all comes down to ratepayers paying these dollars. This is $9 billion of ratepayer money in South Carolina. We're talking about more spending in Canada, and then a lot of the bailouts we've talked about have also been incredibly expensive. And this comes not only you know, at the expense of ratepayers, but it also comes at the health expense for you know, millions of people in the U.S. and worldwide.
Yep, ratepayers and taxpayers, and you're right, it's not just pocketbooks, but it's health and safety and the environment. So we've seen it all before. You know, another part of the small modular reactors push is they didn't get away with the giant big ones. I mean, that was the so-called nuclear renaissance of Bush and Cheney, were these giant reactors. So the ones that got canceled in South Carolina were each 1,100 megawatts in size, which is bigger than most that exist in the U.S., although there are some bigger ones out in Arizona. But some of the new reactor designs that were being pushed, like the French version, was 1,600 megawatts. Now you're really getting bigger. Well, the thing is, it didn't work. That was supposed to be a cost-saving measure. In the case of South Carolina, the initial price tag back in 2008 was $5 billion per reactor. And when they got canceled, the price tag had escalated up to $12.5 billion. And the companies, to their credit, finally said, you know, this is not viable. We have to cancel this project. That was finally a wise decision. But a sister project not far away in Georgia is still underway, completely at public expense, including a total of, let's see here, is it $12 billion in federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantees? And if and when that project goes belly up in Georgia, Vogtle Units 3 and 4, that $12 billion will simply be lost to the U.S. Treasury.
Kevin Kamps, how does it work? I mean, okay, we're at home. We're obviously dependent on electricity. We have a bill from whatever the utility is in our area. That utility is a monopoly, so we don't have, like, we can't shop around for the most part, or almost never. And thus, they have the sort of the rights of monopoly pricing. When you look down your electric bill each month, it says so much for your actual electricity. And then there's all those little tiny fees that all add up. So we actually pay a lot of money. People actually don't know where all that money is going. How does, say, a $9 billion, to go back, a $9 billion bailout or any bailout that's passed on then to ratepayers, if the government itself doesn't step in, or if there's, you know, short of a complete and utter bankruptcy, how does the average person, the homeowner, the renter, how do we find out about what we're paying to bail out these companies?
Yeah, well, in the case of South Carolina, starting a decade ago, the Public Service Commission down there that's supposed to serve the public, they began rubber stamping approvals for everything the nuclear utilities were asking for in terms of rate increases to pay for this proposed new reactor construction project. And over the course of some years, it grew to such an extent that it became one-fifth of every South Carolina electric ratepayer's electric bill that came in the mail. So 20% of everybody's electric bill was just paying for construction and financing costs for these proposed two new reactors.
I want you to keep going, but Nicole, let's let the listener let that sink in. 20% of your monthly bill is for that, is to pay that debt so that these private profit making corporations can get theirs.
I would love to use 20% of my bill for something else.
Yeah, and groups like Friends of the Earth and Savannah Riverside Watch and others pointed out at the time, this is a bad idea. For all the reasons we've talked about, the cost when renewables are so much cheaper, and believe you me, there's plenty of renewable potential in a place like South Carolina in terms of solar, in terms of wind, in terms of energy efficiency. But the thing is, these companies, they make that money on nuclear cost overruns. The nuclear industry pockets that money at public expense. So guess what? They're all for it. And if it's the public paying for everything, then you call that a moral hazard in economics. But in this case, it's a radioactive moral hazard. And the only good news is that when reactors get canceled like this, they can't have meltdowns. They won't release radiation on a routine basis, even without accidents. And they won't make high-level radioactive waste for which we have no solution. So that's the silver lining. And yes, we have to get the ratepayer money returned to the people of South Carolina who were unwitting shareholders in this venture, only they weren't going to get any cut of the profits.
Kevin Kamps is our guest. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. You can go and see his work and the work of his organization at the website beyondnuclear.org. Kevin joins us every Wednesday in this segment on Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear is broadcast every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to us as a podcast at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio, also at Spotify and on Spreaker. We're also talking in studio with Nicole Roussel, who's a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. You know, I want to diverge away from this story a little bit, Kevin, and ask you about, again, the convergence of economies, technology, energy, and politics. And that, again, this seems like it's a faraway story, but in fact, it connects to us in numerous ways. And that is the story of, which we've discussed in the past, the story of Germany. And the reason I'm raising it is that Angela Merkel has announced that she is stepping down as the Christian Democratic Union Party leader, a party that she's been the leader of for the past 18 years. She's also been the Chancellor of Germany since 2005, and her decision is an indication that she has been weakened as a consequence of the immigration issues, problems with the German economy, and so on. But I want to ask you, because we're talking about the intersection of politics and policy, what Merkel's departure might mean for Europe, but what it might also mean for everybody doing the kind of work that you're doing, which is to try to advocate for an alternative to nuclear energy and nuclear power. There's an article that I'm looking at from the San Francisco Chronicle about this. I want to read a little bit from it and then get you to comment. Merkel's departure will be profound for Europe. She has helped the continent weather a conflation of crises, including the 2008 Great Recession, Russian interventions in Georgia and Ukraine, and successive Greek bailout negotiations that challenged the stability of the Eurozone. I might put that a little bit differently. Through it all, she remained a cautious, principled coalition builder. Twice she took another path, each time with mixed results. In the aftermath of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster, Merkel announced that Germany would abandon its reliance on civilian nuclear power and fossil fuels and turn to green energy. That surprised and angered neighboring countries dependent on Germany's energy grid. Since then, Germany has spent hundreds of billions of euros subsidizing renewables, meaning renewable energy sources, yet it remains heavily dependent on the dirty lignite coal. It's failed to lower its greenhouse gas emissions and has abandoned its near-term climate goals. Now, Kevin, you have pointed over and over again to Germany as an example of a modern, industrialized, late-stage capitalist country that could make a decision to go away from nuclear, to embrace renewable and other energy sources. And again, this was under the leadership of Angela Merkel. And again, as the San Francisco Chronicle is pointing out, it angered some interests in Germany. It also angered some of Germany's neighbors, at least the elites in those countries. Anyway, let's talk about Merkel's departure and what it might mean. And do you believe, having studied the issue, whether Germany, as this kind of pioneering entity, will actually stay on the course to abandon nuclear energy altogether?
Yeah, well, just to set the record straight, Merkel did not agree to a nuclear power phase out of the goodness of her heart all of a sudden because she was watching Fukushima blow up on the television. It was a political necessity for her to do that in terms of political survival, because it just so happened that shortly after the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe began on March 11th of 2011, there were regional elections in Germany, like just what just happened within recent days, and Merkel's party did so poorly just now that she is stepping down. Back in 2011, they also did poorly in places where they were expected to dominate, like they had since the late 1940s, places like Stuttgart and Bremen. Incredibly, the conservatives lost to the Greens in those places, which was a direct response of the German people, even in conservative areas, to the Fukushima news. And a part of the reason for such a response was that Germany very much lived under the Chernobyl cloud. And, you know, the Green Party in Germany, which is a powerful force politically, they were anti-nuke from the beginning in the 1970s. The Social Democrats, more like American Democratic Party, they got it after Chernobyl in 1986. And by the year 2000, the coalition Green and Social Democrat ruling party in Germany had agreed on a nuclear power phase-out by the year 2020. Then in came Merkel and the conservatives in 2005, and they tried to undo, they did undo the nuclear power phase-out. But then, like I just described, Fukushima happened. So even the conservatives took an anti-nuclear position for political survival in Germany. And the current phase-out plan is 2022. And I think that that's going to be abided by, because many of the companies have gotten out of the nuclear power business and they've gotten into the renewable energy business and the energy efficiency business. So the energy transformation in Germany was never going to happen overnight. It was a decades-long transition, nuclear power phased out by 2022, greenhouse gas emissions reduced by 85% levels by mid-century. Again, it's going to take, you know, not years, but even decades to get there. So we'll see what happens in Germany politically. But, you know, the conservative party's take on renewable energy, again, is not from the goodness of their heart. They have explicitly said, this is a market decision. This is a business decision we're making under our capitalist principles to be the world leader in renewable energy systems like solar, like wind, like energy efficiency. And we're going to make a lot of money internationally by doing this. And the U.S., by contrast, is dragging its heels and getting left in the dust because we're sticking with coal and natural gas and nuclear power and really sabotaging in many places like Ohio, for example, the tremendous wind power potential that's there. We're making terrible business decisions, let alone climate decisions.
I think that's such an important point. Again, Kevin Kamps is our guest. Kevin, because I'm a socialist and I'm for socializing all energy industries so that they can be used for the benefit of society on a sustainable basis. But let's face it, Germany is not socialist. And your point, I think, is extremely important, is that you don't have to actually be a socialist in order to say, you could be an all-out capitalist to say, look, there's a different way to produce energy other than the nuclear industry. And in fact, once the government makes the decision, once the policy changes in terms of favoring, subsidizing, supporting one particular industry, another industry will arise, in this case, renewable energies, for instance, which are greener and safer. And from the point of view of the capitalists and capitalist corporations and capitalist banking, if there's money to be made on any investment or any commodity, regardless of the shape or form or nature of it, that will be done. So it's really not an existential question in this instance about whether the system is a socialist system or it's a capitalist decision, a system. It's really about whether the vested interests around corporate capitalism and the nuclear industry prevail and have such a dominating influence over government and over policymakers that they always get their way, regardless of the economic and certainly regardless of the environmental and of the human consequences. In essence, that's what you're saying.
You know, it was such a pleasure. Last week, I was on a speaking tour in Iowa and to see the wind turbines being built. And again, it was a business decision in Iowa. It was a business decision made by MidAmerican Energy, owned by Warren Buffett, the billionaire capitalist. And, you know, lots of wind turbines to be seen traveling around. And that business decision was made in direct response to them not getting away with corporate socialism in Iowa. A colleague who hosted my speaking tour, Mike Carberry, with Green State Solutions in Iowa, beat MidAmerican's lobbyists, his coalition of environmentalists and the American Association for the Advancement of Retired Persons, ARP, because, you know, old folks didn't want to be spending towards new reactor construction, which is Warren Buffett's original idea. They'd never even see the electricity. It takes so long to build the reactors. So once Buffett lost trying to foist these costs on the public in Iowa, he immediately turned to his plan B, which was wind power. So that's what's happening now. So, you know, if it makes sense on Warren Buffett's ledgers, then it probably makes sense from a business perspective. And German capitalists seem to get that. But I will point out that the Social Democrats in Germany have a real strong element of socialism, as do the Greens there. And so we'll see if they happen to weather this political storm in Germany and retake power there, I would expect to see an acceleration of these investments in renewables and efficiency.
Yeah, I'm so glad we've had a chance to talk about this because it also demonstrates that there are so many more powerful factors at play in decision-making rather than the personality of the person who has the office of authority. That's true for Angela Merkel. It's true for Donald Trump. It's true for Barack Obama. Many, many factors, some business, some economic, some societal. Bottom line, it's also about people and about what people do, what kind of movements people build. We are joined, as we are every Wednesday, by Kevin Kamps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can go to their website at beyondnuclear.org. And we're also joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer and Sputnik News analyst Nicole Roussel. Nicole, where do we go next?
Well, I wanted to touch on something that's actually really related to what you were just talking about, Brian. One of the factors, as you mentioned, can be the business interests in the U.S. The business interests are one of the biggest factors that create public policy. And, you know, we've seen for years the nuclear power industry really try to claim that nuclear power is the only way that we can solve the climate crisis, and that nuclear power is green and that it's good for people and it's good for, you know, health and it's good for the air. And there's a couple of new updates on that that I was hoping Kevin might want to get into. We see here that MacArthur, a really prominent kind of considered somewhat liberal foundation, is working with a literal CEO of Exelon, a nuclear power corporation, to place op-eds in papers. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I mean, they literally say the only in this op-ed that the only way to fix the climate crisis is we have to consider all forms of energy, which, you know, I think there are many arguments against. But Kevin, do you want to talk a little bit more about this MacArthur op-ed?
Yeah, it appeared October 12th in Time magazine, for one, and it is painful. I mean, I think it's doing damage to our prospects on the climate when an institution like the MacArthur Foundation teams up with Exelon Nuclear to promote its business interest, which is nuclear power. Exelon's the biggest nuclear reactor operator in the United States with more than a couple dozen atomic reactors. And, you know, subsidizing nuclear power, which essentially is what they're calling for there, to recognize its low carbon benefits, has an impact societally. It's going to steal money away from renewables, which deserve some subsidies because nuclear has enjoyed such subsidies from the start in the 1950s, and they still do. So just to be specific, I mean, New York State is subsidizing Exelon Nuclear to the tune of $7.6 billion over 10 years out of a clean energy fund that was very hard won by environmental activists over years, and is taking that money away from renewables, which could create orders of magnitude more jobs, and is using that money to prop up four old atomic reactors in upstate New York on Lake Ontario just to preserve something like 2,000 jobs. So these are platinum-plated jobs at these dangerously old atomic reactors, some of which are pushing 50 years old at this point, and, you know, stunting, preventing the development of renewable solar wind efficiency like they could be developing. It's a real sabotage campaign by a company like Exelon that, you know, may have its greenwashing solar project here or its greenwashing wind energy project over there. In fact, Exelon got kicked out of the American Wind Energy Association, of which it was a member because it has a wind power division, because it was intentionally and deliberately sabotaging wind power subsidies at the federal level. And the rest of the wind power industry said, you know what, with friends like that, you can leave. They got kicked out of the association. So it's too bad, but the nuclear power industry is politically powerful, and they're probably pulling out all stops at this point to try to keep their gravy train going. And unfortunately, they persuaded MacArthur Foundation to join them.
And again, regarding the 2,000 jobs, there could be easily a commitment to conversion, to job conversion, so that no one has to, quote, lose a job. They may have to lose that particular job. But the government can, as it does in many, many instances, make guarantees. Certainly when the banks needed to be bailed out, they got $7.7 trillion in loan guarantees on top of the $660 billion with cash, no strings attached, that they could spend. The government could make a commitment to conversion, no?
Yeah, and you know, in fact, at those old reactors in upstate New York, they have lots of high-level radioactive waste that needs to be safeguarded and secured and managed for years to come on-site. And then they should be closing the reactors as soon as possible for safety reasons alone. And then they have to decommission those facilities. They have to dismantle the buildings. They have to clean up the radioactive contamination. There is plenty of work to do, not for years, but for decades to come, just to clean up the mess that they've made up there. And, you know, the workers who are in place know the facilities the best. They should be retained to do that work. So all of these arguments are pretty facetious to begin with. So it's time to, you know, let nuclear power die and to move towards the clean and safe and affordable energy of the future, which is wind and solar and efficiency.
Kevin, we've only got 90 seconds left, and I'm sorry to leave this till the very end, but just today, a bunch of watchdog groups have released a press release talking about the administration violating the National Environmental Law and Public Review. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and tell us what's going on? 90 seconds left.
Yeah, at both Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Complex in New Mexico and at Savannah Riverside Nuclear Weapons Complex in South Carolina, there's a sudden proposal to quadruple plutonium pit production for nuclear weapons from 20 per year, the current by law capability, up to 80 per year. And they're skipping National Environmental Policy Act analyses to do that in a great big hurry. So watchdog groups in all of these places and out in California too are challenging this violation of the law. And it's a shot across the bow. You'd better do your environmental analysis or we will see you in court, essentially.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin joins this show Loud and Clear every Wednesday for this segment called Beyond Nuclear. You can go to his website, beyondnuclear.org. We encourage everyone not only to learn about these vital issues regarding nuclear power and nuclear energy, issues that affect society, that affect our neighborhoods. We want people to know about it, but we also want people to get involved, and you can do so by going to the site beyondnuclear.org and signing up with the organization, learn about what they're doing, get their emails. And we've also been joined in studio, as we are most Wednesdays, by Nicole Roussel. She is the Loud and Clear producer, the producer of this show, and she is a Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.